Welcome to Not Enough Champagne, a podcast that always receives its just desserts. My name's Corey Hazelhurst, and with me is my partner in propaganda, Steve Haynes.
Hello, the internet.
This season of Not Enough Champagne has all been about personal responsibility. And what better example of personal responsibility could there be than working hard and paying your taxes? Well, how about the latest fashionable idea that unites Paul Mason and Naomi Klein with Milton Friedman and Richard Nixon, that unites Tom Paine and Bertrand Russell with Friedrich Hayek? The idea is, of course, universal basic income, and it's the subject of this week's podcast.
Universal basic income is one of those ideas which gets thrown around a lot, almost as though it's just like a universal solution to every single issue. Given its prevalence in a lot of political discussion currently, we thought we'd spend some time to begin with just kind of going through the basics with it.
The universal basics.
Yeah, the universal basics of universal basic income. So universal basic income is a policy designed basically to replace the current, the standard way that welfare is done. Rather than, you know, having a string of benefits which would go out to people based on certain conditions, such as, you know, you're over a certain age, therefore you get a pension, you're unemployed, therefore you get unemployment benefit.
Unemployed and looking for a job,
I should say. Yeah, or you know, you get tax credits for having kids, or whatever. Under a UBI scheme, all of those would be gone and everybody would just get a single lump sum. For the purposes of this explanation, we will just assume that, you know, that's £10,000 a year, because it's a nice, relatively easy figure for us to talk about. The thing with UBI is everybody gets that £10,000. That money is put into your bank account by the government, and then it is yours to do with as you wish. It goes on your living expenses, or it goes on your rent, it goes on your weekly shopping, it goes on whatever you like. There are variants of this now, and the variants tend to be favoured more by the right wing than the left. So in that list that Corey mentioned earlier, where we're talking about Hayek and Friedman, they actually favour something called a negative income tax, which is essentially the same thing as universal basic income, but it has a tapering off period. So rather than it being a case of everybody gets £10,000, it means that if you're earning £7,500 a year, the government would give you £2,500 so that you reach that basic threshold.
So it's like the Lib Dem proposal to increase the personal allowance, but it's a kind of even sexier version of that.
Yeah, it is along a similar kind of notion. It's about kind of setting a threshold. This is what you need, how much money you need to actually live. We should make sure that everybody gets it.
Another reason why you tend to get a lot of libertarian types like Milton Friedman in favour of a universal basic income is because they see it as a way of reducing government bureaucracy.
Absolutely. I mean, when you consider the myriad of different benefits that are available, and anybody who's been unemployed or has seen I, Daniel Blake, of which I have not, will be able to kind of attest to the number of forms and the bureaucracy that you have to go through to get even your basic unemployment benefits. Because everybody's just getting this money, you know, it's seen as a much simpler, more elegant solution to welfare payments.
And I think that's why UBI's been taken up by a lot of the left as well. There was a Compass pamphlet on UBI, and I think one of the justifications for that is because of the punitive benefit system which we see in the crackdown and what have you, and under IDS.
The assumption behind universal basic income is such that everybody gets it, therefore there's no moral judgment to be made about anybody on there. You can't turn around and say, well, you're not worthy of it because of, you know, because you're not looking for work or whatever, because everybody gets it.
So I suppose, yeah, the right don't like, the libertarians don't like means testing because it's intrusive government bureaucracy, and the left don't like it because they see it as immoral.
Yes.
There have been some trials of it. There's been trials, there's talk in Scotland. There's going to be a few trials there. There's been trials in Namibia. There's been trials in India, apparently, and Canada as well.
Yeah, the Canadian one was particularly interesting in that it actually showed a lot of positive effects, particularly around things like unemployment rate and just general health and mental well-being as well. The other trials are currently in the process, as I think is the case in Finland.
The Finland one's quite interesting, actually, because it's been used in Finland, I think, because unemployment in Finland is slightly higher than it is in other Scandinavian countries. So it's about 8% or 8.1%, which is a little bit higher than a lot of its neighbours. In Finland, there tend to be a lot of workers on short-term contracts. And if workers are on those short-term contracts, then their benefits are tapered off quite quickly. So you've got a situation where workers don't really want to be on short-term contracts because then they lose their benefits, and then when your contract ends, it's more difficult for you to find a job after that. So there's a random trial going on at the moment, and the Finnish government, they're paying some job seekers in this trial the equivalent of £477 a month, which they will get, even if they get another job, they will keep that in addition. And I think the idea is to see what happens, to see if there are these positive effects, as you say.
I think the interesting thing about that, though, is when you look at those that figure, that 470 odd quid a month, I mean, if you take that and put it out over the year, what's that, about £5,000?
Yeah, so this is my back of the envelope calculation. That would be £5,724 a year. Now, if we assume that in Britain that 50 million adults would get it, I suppose it depends, because remember Switzerland rejected universal basic income in the referendum. Now, the terms of that said that an adult would receive 2,500 Swiss francs a month.
Mm-hmm.
But then children would also receive a UBI. They'd get 625 francs a month. I suppose it's like child tax credits,
basically.
But 77% oppose that in the referendum. But if you take that, as you say, about £5,000, 50 million adults, that becomes £286.2 billion a year.
Which is an awful lot of money.
Now, to put that into context, total UK public spending this year is £784.1 billion. So that would be, it's the equivalent of a third of all UK public spending. However, of that, about £157 billion is spent on pensions and £113 billion is spent on welfare. So if you look at UBI as a way of restructuring your welfare payments, we already spend at the moment £270 billion on welfare, whether it's in social security or pensions. So it would only be an extra cost of £16 billion.
Only 16 billion here, a billion there, and soon you're talking real numbers. In terms of like the mathematics of it, in terms of government budgets, probably feasible to be able to do. I mean, finding that extra 16 billion is still going to be a pretty impressive task.
We should leave the EU because
but there's also just some other issues with it. Based on those numbers alone, that just means you'll be getting £5,000 a year, which is great for someone like you or me, where we're in employment and we're being given an extra £5,000 a year. Wonderful. That's an extra £5,000 I can spend on guitars. It's holidays. It's wine. It's whatever.
Champagne.
Yeah, exactly. Champagne, because you've never had enough. But the reality is, for the people who actually need the most help in society, the people who are unemployed, £5,000 a year ain't a lot of money for you to get all of your, get your rent paid, to buy your food, to do all of those things. You know, in effect, it probably doesn't work out as that much more than what you're currently getting under the benefit system anyway.
Well, the Compass pamphlet I talked before, they did a couple of simulations on UBI, and they found that if you did give a simple flat rate as UBI, then a lot of those households at the bottom, they did lose out compared to others. I mean, one example could be people with disabilities, but obviously the costs and what have you for them are more. So as you say, £5,000 a year is a few more bottles of wine. It's a lot more bottles of wine for us, but actually that's not enough for someone with disability to live on.
Mm-hmm. And this is going to be one of the biggest issues about UBI, and I think one of the reasons why it's almost been overhyped as a solution to problems. I think when we talk about it, we almost kind of go in there with the notion that it would be, oh yeah, and so it would be a living wage for every single person in the country, which, you know, in theory, the minimum wage should just about be enough to get by on. just about, not necessarily contribute further to society, which is what the definition of a living wage is, but a minimum wage you can survive on. That doubles those figures that we've just discussed, and that takes us up to twice the level. We'd be looking at almost two-thirds of the UK budget spent solely on what would effectively be the welfare system. And this is one of the reasons where I think if something like this is going to be brought in, it's going to be the negative income tax variant. It's going to be Friedman and Hayek rather than Payne and Mason's version, because that tapering off is there. It's the assertion that, you know, there is a minimum standard that the government will guarantee.
In the Compass pamphlet, their version of UBI just ends up essentially being a strengthening of universal benefits anyway.
Yeah.
I think it depends what problem you're trying to solve. So if you're looking at the problem of means testing and government bureaucracy,
it's brilliant. It solves that.
Makes sense. The reason why Naomi Klein and Paul Mason like it, I think, is because they see it as being an adapting to the new economy. In the case of Naomi Klein, it was in This Changes Everything, which is a book on climate change. So UBI is almost a way of, you give people money so they don't have to consume stuff, because if you consume stuff, it consumes energy and carbon. That
doesn't make
sense. Just go with it. Go with the point, Steve. But
I need to just go critique with the point. That.
Can you do it later?
Yes. Because,
right. But that's the idea. It's about going to a more carbon-free economy, basically. With the Paul Mason view, so Post-Capitalism is the book it's in, and that's all about how automation is going to destroy everything and remove jobs and neoliberalism, blah. He has UBI because it's a way, especially with the new gig economy we've got, it's a way of maybe boosting the income and improving the life and jobs and security and general welfare of those people who are on short-term contracts.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's why it's being brought in there. I think the problem with that, though, is it feels a little bit utopian to say that if you're on a 0 hours contract, we'll give you $5,000 a year. You'll maybe work 2 or 3 days a week. I mean, this is what Keynes was arguing in Economic Possibilities for Our Grandchildren, which was an essay written in 1945, in which he said in the future, we'll all be on 15 hour weeks because of technology, it will make our lives even better. And that's one thing actually that hasn't been proved true. That actually probably
technological progression has occurred, but technological progression and has made things, our lives in many ways, easier. But it makes things easier, but those things also have costs associated with them. Therefore, we need to earn money to do those things. And that's something that Keynes didn't seem to take into account.
And the tapering off of work hours hasn't happened either. I mean, I like the idea of UBI because it shows there are other things in life which should be rewarded as opposed to work. I mean, there's a few people, like the Finnish trade unions and a few other people who are more on the unionist, like the old-fashioned Labour right, those
yeah.
trade union lot in the Labour right, who talk about how they don't like UBI because of the dignity of work, which is not really something that I'm sold with, because work is just inherently soul-destroying and pointless and terrible.
Only if you don't enjoy it.
True. Well, it's more,
I mean, this is the thing with this sort of stuff. It's like, I can get entirely where those kind of unions are coming from. Even if I was able to survive, and even comfortably survive, on the money and on a handout from the government, I'd still do something with my time, because I'd get bored, because, you know, I want to contribute something.
And I think this is the argument, isn't it? That, say, the things that you can reward as well as work. Well, I mean, there's care, for instance, which is going to be a massive issue in the future. It gives you care, and at the moment, care work isn't paid, but that should be valued. You'd have more leisure time. We could produce more podcasts. Imagine how amazing that would be. We could have daily episodes of Not Enough Champagne. Maybe that's the best argument against UBI.
Yeah, probably is.
For instance, I mean, songwriting. I mean, you've been talking about going to open mic nights writing songs. You could participate in culture and write more songs and have the time to do that in a way you don't at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, and absolutely, kind of being able to create the ability for people to engage with that sort of thing is absolutely something that governments should aspire to. I mean, I think we've discussed previously on when we've talked about education, we were talking about how the best educational systems are the ones which focus on the arts as well as the sciences. And so, yeah, aspiring to be able to provide people access to culture, for lack of a better term, is a very laudable aim. But I'm not necessarily sure that a UBI system would actually do that. Participation in those sorts of areas is not based around necessarily around time. The reality is, every weekend I could go to a museum. There are dozens of them around the West Midlands I can get to really easily and for cheap. I choose not to.
But is that because at the end of a working week, you're that knackered that all you want to do is just sit in your pants eating crisps?
That does sound very fun. But but no, generally speaking, on weekends, I'm doing stuff. And most people are, an awful lot of people are doing stuff on their weekends. Now, maybe that stuff is going down the football, but they're doing it. Maybe it's going down the pub with their mates, but they're doing it. And they're making that choice to do it. They have that opportunity, but they don't do so. Because the thing is, whilst I'm sat here saying the arts is good, people should be able to participate in it, I only choose to participate in a very limited number of them. I like music. I like poetry to a certain extent. I don't go to museums very often because I don't find them very interesting. To be quite honest, I've got a history degree, but I don't find them that interesting unless they're really specific ones. Like, I like military museums. I've lived in Birmingham my entire life. I can count the number of times I've been to the Birmingham's art gallery and museum on one hand.
Even to see the Anglo-Saxon Horde?
I've never been to see the Anglo-Saxon Horde.
You disgust me.
I know, I'm dreadful. But it's a classic example.
Reference.
Yeah, tick. But it's a classic example of that. I'm interested in one section of the arts, or one or two sections. Other people are interested in other sections of the arts. The notion that the arts are a singular blob you engage with isn't accurate. There's lots of little sections of it which people choose to engage with. And the reality is, like all forms of culture, we choose what we're interested in and we engage with it. And the reality is we have enough time, for the most part, for us to be able to engage with it. That doesn't mean that everybody can. There are obviously people who are working 7 days a week and who don't get that opportunity because that's what they need to do to survive. But for most people, if you're earning a living wage, which is 15 grand a year, which most people are, you're on enough to get by. And you can choose what to engage with.
But life should be about more than getting by, Steve. We should be able to experience better, bigger, more cultural things.
You're just trolling me now, aren't you?
A little bit of column A and a little bit of column B, if I'm perfectly honest. I think the problem with UBI, though, is that it's an incredibly difficult sell politically. I mean, we've had the conversation in the office, and this was actually a political conversation in the office I didn't start. So I'm always particularly proud of these. One of the younger members in my office is very, very idealistic and was trying to explain to our line manager about universal basic income. And she just said, so you're going to pay people thousands of pounds a year to do nothing. And of course, at that point, there's this kind of...
silence.
This uncomprehending mist silence. Because on the one hand, I'd like to think that actually people would take that time and they'd have the time to do more cultural things. But I also know that a lot of people wouldn't bother working at all and would just try and sit in their pants eating crisps. And I think that's, in terms of the expense of it, as we've said, it's maybe not that much more expensive, but I think the problem is anyone actually going to bother working and pay taxes if you give them a certain amount of money to do nothing?
Well, I think an awful lot of people would continue to work and pay taxes for us to continue with the lifestyles that we're accustomed to. We're not rich by any stretch of the imagination, but we're both very comfortable, I think. We're not going to stop working to live off 5 grand a year, even if it was technically feasible, because there's all kinds of things that we want to do.
Mm.
You know, I've got a guitar addiction I need to feed, you know, so... but
he snorts them, listeners. It's
true. You shouldn't see what I do to my Stratocaster. It's dreadful. So for the vast majority of people, I think actually you would find that they'd just look at that 5 grand as a nice bonus. There would be very few people who would actually take it as an excuse to do nothing. And the ones who are getting it and aren't doing anything are probably the ones who are getting all the money from the state currently and not doing anything anyway. So
that makes it sound like some sort of massive Keynesian demand stimulus.
Yeah, I think probably that would probably be the biggest impact of it would be a boost in demand, because it's a constant supply of money which the government's always going to provide, and the government can just print more money. And given that
it's never gone wrong before.
Well, no, but given that it's a guarantee, it's a stable amount based around per person, you can predict exactly, you can look at any given point and go, okay, when this is the population, or this is the projected population of the country in that year, we can make a short, medium and long-term estimate about what the economy is going to be and how much money is going to be required. So it shouldn't, touch wood, have a massive impact on things like inflation. But you know, you can do that. It's something you can plan for because of the nature of what it is. But it would, in fact, end up being just a giant demand stimulus, which has added bonuses.
Yeah, but that makes it seem less revolutionary than it really is, because I think the reason it's more popular is because it's seen as this big new idea that's going to revolutionise anything. Do you think if it was brought in, it wouldn't actually be that revolutionary then?
I think UBI is just tax credits, but done without the bureaucracy. Tax credits and things like that are very, very similar in a lot of ways to this. It's the notion that you are in a situation and the government will give you money to help you out. It's not too dissimilar to that. The only difference is it becomes non-means tested, so it is just a kind of a logical evolution of certain policies that we already have in place.
So maybe it's a way of revolutionising the welfare system that way. I mean, Tony Judt has written about how the introduction of universal benefits in the 50s and 60s helped secure middle class support for the welfare state, because those benefits were universal, the welfare state was no longer seen as being
something that the poor had to do.
The preserve of people at the bottom. Whereas I think now there is certainly that view that actually welfare isn't for people like us.
Here's the thing is because everybody's, an awful lot of people, especially if you've got kids, have already got something from the welfare column of the budget. Like, again, child tax credits, for instance. But they don't view them as welfare. They view them as a benefit for themselves. Their benefits versus what welfare is are very different things. Welfare is what you give to the poor people.
Okay.
Benefits are what they have.
Do you think the main purpose of UBI is to try and shift the Overton window and yank it further to more progressive ways of welfare? So for instance, I mean, we talked about the Compass pamphlet on UBI, and that argues essentially we don't want a flat UBI and giving everyone £6,000 a year or £10,000 a year. We just want instead a kind of increase in universal benefits and a lessening of welfare bureaucracy. If we've got people, say like the Green Party at 2015, they're advocating a UBI, does that give other progressives like Labour, like the Lib Dems, more space to argue for a reworking of Social Security?
In theory, yes. I mean, that tends to be how the Overton window operates, but in practice, I think it's a very hard sell. I don't think it matters how many outriders you've got. I don't think it matters if the Greens are doing it. I don't think it matters even if John McDonnell, the Shadow Chancellor, is saying, this is something we're looking at. At the end of the day, you still have to find a way to get past that you're paying people to do nothing argument, which it's very difficult to do because you are paying people to do nothing. You can add riders to it and say, okay, you've got to be... I know if you're not working, you need to be spending X amount of hours doing something for charity or whatever, or contributing to society in some way.
But it's not universal.
Exactly. Yeah. It just becomes an extension of the welfare state.
And you still end up having that bureaucracy, wouldn't you?
Yeah, in some form or another. And this is why I don't think we're ever actually going to see something that actually is universal basic income as it's envisaged. I think we will see an extension of the welfare state, which moves towards it. And I think it will be called a universal basic income, but I don't think it will be in practice.
A bit like George Osborne brought in the national living wage, even though that's not actually a living wage. It's a bit below where you would have your living wage if it was a living wage. I do hope that sentence makes sense, listeners. It did in my head.
It made sense to me, so I get what you mean. Okay. But yeah, it's very similar to that, I'd say.
So in the Swiss referendum, we alluded to it earlier, but 77% rejected universal basic income at that referendum. We talked about referendums on the death penalty in a previous podcast, and I dread to think what a referendum on universal basic income.
I don't think if you were to try and introduce it by referendum, it would get slaughtered. You're probably looking at about an 80-20 split by my reckoning. And I think the reason for that is that as a nation, we are very individualist. Rightly or wrongly, benefits and flaws that come with that, but we are an individualist nation as a culture. Some slightly more communitarian based ones, such as the Nordics, Nordic states, they might be able to get away with it and be able to put something in place and it be accepted. For Britain, no, I don't think that would work.
Is that because the increasing inequality we've seen over 30, 40 years just leads to that more individualistic society and that decline of empathy?
I don't think it's got anything to do with that. I think it's just British nature. I think if you look back at the kind of like an awful lot of the culture that Britain has compared it to an awful lot of European states and European peoples and the European culture, we've always been very, very individualistic in comparison. There's a reason that Adam Smith wrote The Wealth of Nations, and it's because he was British and he had a culture and grew up in a culture which has a very specific way of looking at the world. Yes, Britain used to be much more community oriented, but I don't think we've ever been community oriented in the same way as the Nordic states have. I think it's been very different, and I think that's not going to change.
I think possibly we had that sort of community orientated, say in the 50s and 60s when you had that high welfare state. I just don't think we have it now. We don't have that for a number of reasons, but maybe UBI could be a way of trying to switch it the other way.
I'm just not convinced. I think there's an awful lot of this was a golden age of looking back analysis on that kind of aspect of Britain's past. I mean, sure, it was more community orientated back then, but I don't necessarily think it's as great as it was made out to be. I'm not convinced, personally.
Yeah, I suppose it's the thing with small communities where, on the one hand, communities are quite a good thing. On the other hand, if everyone knows everything about what people are doing, and you've got cases of, Mrs. So-and-so has bought more meat than she usually does. I wonder if anyone's living here with her who wasn't before. I think there can be a lot of that. So, swings and roundabouts. On interesting ideas that maybe you should carry out in the future, maybe you should try and subscribe to us on iTunes or anywhere else you get your podcasts. If you could rate and leave a review while you're there, it does help people discover the show. Our theme tune is Pucky Good Times by Dave Depper, and James Cram designed our logo. You can follow him at Twitter at James Cram. You can follow me on Twitter at Paperback Writer.
And you can follow me on at Centre Radical.
We'll be back next week talking about other unworkable policies. Speak to you then.
Bye.
You have 30 seconds to talk about the consumerism of society.
If you give people money, they will spend it. If you, by virtue of just giving people money, you will make people spend it, which increases consumerism, not decreases it.
That was 10 seconds. That's not bad.